doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're here broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. Today we have a great show. We have Andre Dubuse III. He's a National Book Award finalist, and he's here to talk about his latest novel, The Garden of the Last Days, published by Norton. Hi, Andre.
Hey, Barbara, how are you?
Great. Great to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Let me tell you, I've got a cordless phone. It sounds like this battery's going, so if you hear a beeping, I'm going to switch phones.
Okay, no problem. You sound good.
Okay.
Anyway, For our listeners who are new to the Garden of the Last Days, would you take just a few minutes and talk about the genesis of the book?
Yeah, it's a novel that's set on the Gulf Coast of Florida in the late summer of 2001. And what really gave birth to the whole book is an image I had in my head that I didn't know where it came from. And over the years, I've really come to trust these images that float around. And it was an image of a wad of cash on a bedroom bureau, and I started to write myself into it. And very quickly became clear that these were tips, and they weren't the tips of a waiter or bartender, but of a stripper. And then I realized where that image came from. It came from these strange little articles, you know, we'd read after that terrible day of some of these hijackers having been seen in strip clubs. And I couldn't get my mind around that. How could they be so extremist in their interpretation of Islam to do what they did, but and then go to strip clubs? But at the same time, I was even more curious as to what it would be like to be a woman who has danced for one of these men, and then after the smoke is cleared from that terrible day, what would it be like to have his blood money in her possession? And that's really what gave birth to the whole novel.
Hmm. How did it become a multiple point of view novel?
Beats me. and that's an honest answer. You know, so much of this creative writing thing, as you know, is intuitive. One thing just kept leading to another. And, you know, if you'll actually look at the word intuition, it comes from the, I don't know if it's Greek or Latin root, but it actually, the archaic meaning is to guard. And I think so often this intuition that we all have kind of guards something higher or larger that we're not fully conscious of. And so I just kept getting these intuitive impulses from other characters that they wanted the microphone, they wanted to talk, they wanted to be in the story as much as another character. And so I let it roam. Actually, the final draft that I submitted to my publisher had 5 points of view that aren't in the, I think there are 7 in the finished book, and I think there are about 12 in the draft I sent the publisher before I sliced them away.
And how did you decide who goes? Who went?
What's that?
How did you decide who was to go?
Well, you know, Faulkner's got that great line, you got to murder your darlings.
Yeah.
And I think what a good editor does, and I have a really good editor at W.W. Norton, they kind of give you a loaded gun and point out the darlings. And it's a terrible thing. But I honestly think that the ones that had to go were the ones that felt a little bit superfluous and more like me, the writer, enjoying kind of wandering off the path of the novel into these little eddies. And honestly, I felt that the novel needed some break from the dramatic action, and I enjoyed wandering down these little eddies and just going to peripheral characters' lives for a little bit. But in the end, there were just a little too many eddies, mm-hmm. and they had to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know your characters so very well, and one thing I notice that's similar between this book and The House of Sand and Fog is that you create these conflicts that are that as a reader you're able to understand both points of view and actually root for both characters or all characters. Mm. So that in House of Sand and Fog, you know, I wanted the homeowner whose house was I think foreclosed upon and the Persian man to both have the house, that it was both of their houses, and the same with this book where your character April, where AJ, where they all are flawed, and you're just rooting away for them to come through. And how do you get at that? And are you purposefully trying to create characters that have these various sides and dimensions?
Well, first, thank you for those kind words. I mean, that really is music to my ears that they feel that real to you. You know, to answer your question directly, I don't think I'm conscious of doing this. I don't think I'm consciously thinking, man, I want to have a really flawed character that the reader roots for. I don't think I'm doing that at all. I will tell you this. You know, there's a wonderful essay by the writer Flannery O'Connor called The Nature and Aim of Fiction. And for, you know, all your listeners who are fiction writers, if they haven't read that, they really should. In The Nature and Aim of Fiction, and every line of this essay is quotable, but she has this one line that a writer's beliefs are not what she sees, but the light by which she sees. And so, you know, I look back at what I've written the last few years, especially these past 2 novels, House of Sand and Fog and The Garden of Last Days, and I see one thing I believe, which is that there's no such thing as good people or bad people. I just don't. That's my humble belief. I don't think they exist. I think that we're all capable of great evil and great good all at once. And this is going to sound blasphemous to some ears, and I don't want to offend anyone, but there's a wonderful line from a Tom Waits song. There is no devil, there's just God when he's drunk.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about that is, you know, I think we're born with full of light and love and truth and beauty and goodness, and we find all kinds of ways to screw that up every day.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Andre Debuse. He's author of The Garden of the Last Days. Along those lines, I as you were saying that, I was thinking that, you know, you sound like you have compassion, and that seems to be one of those qualities of a writer, that if you have compassion, you can give that to your characters. You can find their various sides and make them multidimensional. And if you have no compassion, then it comes out in your writing.
And then it can, what's the last thing you said?
Then it comes out in your writing, and you have, you know, characters that are perhaps, you know, flat, that,
yep,
that maybe don't make you want to root for them. You want to see them just, you know, fall and stay down.
I completely agree. And, you know, there's another essay I'd recommend to your listeners by Tim O'Brien called The Magic Show. And he makes a really brilliant point about characterization. So the reason I think, Barbara, a lot of characters are flat, sometimes in literatures, or especially with beginning writers when they're really working towards making them round and real, is that, and this is often unconscious, I don't think the writer is aware of it all the time, but the writer has already figured out what it is he or she is trying to say. And I think whenever we do that, we do a disservice to our own imaginations and the figures that reside there. One of the things I try to teach my own writing students is, don't outline your stories. You know, there's some wonderful writers who do, but there are many more wonderful writers who don't. And I find it much more helpful not to outline stories, because what happens when you outline your story and start sketching out what it is you think you want to say is, first, you're sending a message to your imagination that you don't trust it. You don't trust it. You don't trust it to do something on its own. And you're going to give it the safety net and these parameters that I would submit to you it does not need. And two, when the characters show up in this thing you've contrived, they're going to have a job to do. There are things you want them to say and not say, because there are points you're trying to make. And then characters become puppets, and you become the puppeteer. And I think the reader always sees that. I think that's always kind of clear. But what O'Brien says in this essay, which I think is so helpful, is that successful characterization is not a nailing down, which TV does all the time, and I think film to a large degree in this country does. It's not a nailing down where, oh, I've got him figured out. Yeah, the peaceable sheriff who just wants a ranch. Oh, yeah, the prostitute with a heart of gold. These are cliches that do disservice to how wildly mysterious and symphonic and miraculous we are inside, and how, frankly, we can never know another. You know, I mean, think of the people you've known your whole lives and loved your whole life, and how honestly, at one level, you still haven't got a clue as to who they are, and you probably never will. So my point is, I think that you're absolutely right, that if you go into the writing with an open-hearted, open-minded sort of state, you're going to find things you didn't know were there.
So then if you let your characters, if you, I guess, are dwelling or focusing on creating characters, then where does plot figure in?
Mm-hmm.
Because plot seems to be just one of those things where if you can, you might be able to write wonderful characters, but if they're just sitting there, then how do you make things happen?
Well, you know, that's a very excellent question. First, they never sit there. I mean, a lot of young writers are guilty of this, and I was one too, where because we tend to be, you know, observers, a lot of main characters are observing people go about their lives, and so the fiction sort of sits there. I'd just like to throw a few definitions out, which I stole from the writer Janet Burroway, and she defined story this way. Story is a causal sequence of events with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you think about that, that's an unromantic, you know, almost depressing stripping down of what story is. But if you think about that definition, it sort of applies to everything you've ever seen or read. But then she defines plot in another way, which I think is really helpful, and it's a way that writers talk about plot. She said, so if story is a causal sequence of events with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and of course we don't have to submit that story in that form. You can start at the end and go back and everything else. But if that's what a story is, she said, then plot is how we arrange those events in order to highlight theme or emotion or impact or aesthetic effect, etc. So what I'm getting at is I don't think writers have to worry about plot nearly as much as they think they do. I think they really just need to let go, because so much of this is an act of faith, is this surrendering to this daily weird thing we do, which takes a lot of faith and a lot of nerve. But what I keep finding again and again is the horse knows the way. And so to get to your point about characters doing something, if you go deeply into character, right? So, and let's look at it this way. If the heart of character-driven fiction is character, then I think setting and landscape and place are the lungs. And without that, the character can't breathe. And when you've got a real character in a real place, things are going to start happening, and story will happen, and then plot is something you deal with after you've written the story.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense. Of course, I love all that. And then I think of, I was thinking of a writer friend who worries a lot about the marketplace. And, you know, she says a lot, you got to keep it moving. You got to keep it moving. You got to keep it exciting. So that the marketplace seems to find its way into a writer's psyche as he or she's writing and thinking, well, is this gonna go over? Is an agent gonna like this?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up. Let me just bring up the D word, please. Let me bring up death. Let me bring up the fact we're all gonna freaking die and screw the market. I cannot tell you enough. All right, I have this theory that if there's any one single enemy to creativity, it is self-consciousness. I think it's probably an enemy to lovemaking or bouncing a basketball or cooking a sauce, too. If we're standing there watching ourselves do this thing instead of being deeply in the moment of doing it, where you have that delicious alchemy of losing yourself in something larger, only to then miraculously find yourself more than ever, then we cannot think ever about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not the same as thinking about the reader. I'm always thinking of the ideal reader. The ideal reader for me is someone who's kind of smart, who's read a lot of books, or is interested in reading books with an open heart and open mind, who will give me 50 pages before he or she throws it across the room. That kind of reader. But I think it's so important not to think about a readership or the market, because then you will be writing from the outside in instead of the inside out, and you won't. And you touched the nerve with me on this one. And that's what I'm saying about the D word. You know, we're all going to croak. May we all live 140 years and die tanned and happy, you know, with our loved one. But look, I say that because do we really want this beautiful spiritual dance that happens in the creative process to be sullied by thinking about, will I make a buck? Will anyone notice me? Will anyone care? Will anyone respect me at a cocktail party because I have a bestseller? I friggin' hope not. All right, that's my two cents on that subject.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Andre Debuse, author of The Garden of the Last Days.
Actually, there's no the in there.
Oh, sorry. You know, I add the to everything. The Garden of Last Days,
yeah.
Published by Norton. He's also author of House of Land and Fog, and you have a book of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was my first published book, and let me make sure this is clear. I truly believe, you know, I'm the son of the great short story writer Andre Debuse, which is why I have that pretentious three on my name, but I hate that three. But the truth is, we must invoke his name because, you know, he published 10 or 11 books.
Oh, he was wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Yeah, and he was primarily, without a doubt, a short story writer and a short story master. I don't think I'm actually a short story writer, but in my 20s, I was teaching myself to write by by writing short fiction first. And it's weird, when I look back, Barbara, I would begin with a very short, tight story, then go to a bit of a longer, more complicated story, then to an even longer one, which is almost novella length, then to the novel. And I've been kind of working my way towards a longer form all along. But I like what Faulkner said. And he said, when the writer starts out, he tries his hand at poetry. And when he fails at that, he tries to write the short story. And when he can't do that either, he ends up writing novels. So, The Cage Cube and other stories. But honestly, I look back fondly at the writing of that book because I was really trying to teach myself about what happens in stories and what makes a story. And a lot of that book came from my 6-8 months working as a counselor in a halfway house for convicted adult felons from Kansas City Penitentiary in Colorado, and I wrote about them for years.
Well, and apparently your first published story was in Playboy and won a National Magazine Award.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you did your homework, huh?
I did my homework. And then your first book, and here's something I wanted to talk about too, was the first book, that book of short stories was rejected by 30 publishers?
Yeah.
Yeah? So what kept you going? Was it...
Well, you know what kept... Honestly, what kept me going is probably... What's the most honest answer here? Well, here's the thing. I didn't expect the world to ever notice me anyway. And back to this self-conscious thing, that was actually probably one of the good things about having the same name as my famous father, now writing in the same vein, is I quickly saw that I was going to be dismissed by everyone and accepted it fairly quickly, that, okay, the world's never going to notice. But why did I keep writing? Well, here's the deal. I never thought I was going to write fiction. I actually got a degree in sociology and political science, and I was heading off, I thought, into either academia or politics or both, and I was just going to donate my life, dedicated to fighting injustice. That's all I was going to do. And I started to date a fiction writer. I began to read fiction, and I got inspired, and I started to write. And after I finished my first story, much to my surprise, it wasn't a good story, but it was sincere. But after I finished it, Barbara, I just felt more like Andre, little me, than I ever had in my entire 21 and a half, 22 years at that point. And honestly, I just can't not do it. I'm on this 40-city insane tour, and I have a notebook with me, not because I'm this disciplined guy, but because if I don't get in some daily words, I just feel far away from me.
Hmm.
And I really think, you know, a lot of young writers will say, well, how do I know if I'm a writer? How do I know if I'm a writer? Well, it's not if Oprah likes your book or if you've got a bestseller or even published. Publishing is a nice problem to have, but that's not what it is. It's this. And I asked them that. Can you go 3 months without writing and feel fine? And if they say yes, they're probably not a writer. Big deal. They're supposed to do something else with their lives. But if I have a young person tell me, no, I can't go 3 days without feeling all screwed up, I said, well, you're probably a writer whether you want to be or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how I kept going.
You just said, though, that you thought you'd be dismissed by everyone because of your famous father. And here I'm thinking, oh, having a literary father is going to help put you on the map.
Well, I didn't find that. So that book went to 30 publishers. My second published book went to about 25. House of Sand and Fog, which put me on the map, went around for 2.5 years before it found its home. And thank God I ended up in Norton because I love it there.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't helping me any. And honestly, I put myself in the shoes of these people. I'm thinking, hey, man, I've got my Ernest Hemingway. I don't need Ernest Hemingway Jr. Go get your own life. So I think I got a lot of that kind of backlash. Hey, screw you, I got my own Hemingway. And I can certainly understand that. And guess what? Back in my 20s, it was a tortured time where I was playing with a pseudonym. I got to have a whole other name. I got to have a made-up name. I can't have the same name. And I probably should have done that, but the reason I couldn't, and this is probably too literal and passionate of me in my 20s, but I couldn't because, as I said, I felt so much like myself for the first time in my existence. It felt like such a true thing for me to be writing words every day. I couldn't put a fake name on it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, there are two Hank Williams, there are two John Kennedys, there are two Alexander Dumas. Actually, there are three Hank Williamses now. Said, well, there are 200 abuses in literature. People just get used to it. So I'm not putting in a fake name.
Oh, that's a great story. And I'm so glad we have you for a half hour more. We're going to take a quick break. Good. We will be right back with more Andre Debuse the Third. So don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Hi, I'm Attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast-track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And I have been here since the top of the hour with Andre Debuse III. His book is The Garden of Last Days, published by Norton. This show will be podcast in another week or so, and you can listen again and pick up what you maybe didn't pick up this time. What you do is you can either go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower, and follow instructions to the podcast. Or you can go directly to the podcast page, which is writersonwriting.blogspot.com, and listen there. Let's bring him back on. Hi there.
Hello.
Oh, so much more to talk about. I was curious, do you start stories or books that you end up abandoning, or, in other words, how do you know when an idea has substance, when it's going to be one you're going to stay with? Because, you know, I think ideas are one thing we writers have no lack of, and it's choosing the one that's going to have longevity, for whether it's a short story and you need to be with it for a month, or a novel and you need to be with it for possibly a few years.
Yeah, great question. Well, my own two cents on that is I try not to, and I know I'm picking on your word choice to make a point, but I have found that I've begun with an idea, I'm dead in the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? If I begin with an idea, if I say, for example, I want to write about the hardship of divorce, death to the fiction, because
sure.
Back to what we were talking about earlier, I truly believe that this is true of me, but I've seen it so much in other people's work, too, with whom I worked in the classroom, and that is, if we set out to say something, we control the fiction and sometimes kill it, and it's a lot like hoping that your athletic child becomes an NFL star, when in fact he just wants to paint and drink beer. You know, what are you going to do? You can't make him go out for football. My point is, but to answer your question about how do you know when you have something, so I begin with an image or just a sliver of something that feels out there. And for me, I know I've got something that's going to keep going when, well, God, it goes back to the gut again. When I feel it when I'm not working on it. I feel it like maybe like a woman feels a baby growing in her womb after a certain period of time. And I actually have used this analogy a lot. I do think that whether you're a male or female writer, that when you're writing a story, you are pregnant with that story, and those cells are multiplying and dividing inside you in some dark, mysterious place, and your job as the writer is simply to get daily nutrients to it by showing up no matter how you feel, sitting at that desk and trying to go farther with it. Now, another thing, Barbara, that I've been thinking about lately and I find myself saying out loud is that I think there's a profound difference in this creative writing thing between making something up and imagining it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you an example. After my novel, House and Fog, I had an idea for a novel I've been having for years. It was an idea, as in, it wasn't really an idea. I'd read about a certain kind of predator, and I still don't want to talk about it. Oh, but let me go back to the pregnancy analogy. That said, I think, therefore, it's kind of problematic if you're in a writing group and you have to share work in progress, because then you're slitting the belly open, you're shining a light in there, you're poking around, and you're saying something like, I don't know if the brown eyes are working for me. It's not good for the baby, for the mother, for the story. Don't do it. So I never talk about what I'm working on. And so, anyway, so I'm not going to tell you all about this idea because I hope one day to get pregnant with it. But I've been wanting to write from the point of view of this weird kind of predator. He's not a violent predator, but this kind of guy I've been reading about off and on. And so I spent 6-8 weeks writing, and I had that feeling that writers often get, that this just feels like a facade. While it's very well detailed, I've been writing long enough that, you know, it's not all crap. It just felt made up, as opposed to this. So then I start writing from the point of view of one of this predator's victims, and all of a sudden, and she's just a lonely woman working in a bank, one of these people who actually fall through the cracks now and then, who find themselves 25, 26 years old and still virgins. These people still exist in America and never had love. And all of a sudden, the creative writing has roots. All of a sudden, I feel that what I'm writing is not made up, but imagined. And I ended up completely abandoning the predator idea, you know, weeks and weeks and months of work, letting it go, put it aside, and went with what was real and true and imagined. And that was this woman. I ended up writing this novella, which ended up publishing, called Marla, about a woman just looking for love, working in a bank. That was it.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. So what about bringing in your life into fiction, aspects of your life, experiences, all that? Do you just let it sort its way in as it does, or do you consciously do it?
I think I tend to let it sort its way in as it does, because you never know what's you anyway. I mean, you know, there's that famous line from Sarah Orne Jewett, we write what you know, which is wonderful advice if it's not taken too literally. What I love about that advice is that so many people think their lives aren't worth plumbing, and every life is worth expressing. Every life is worth at least 2 volumes, if not 50. So that's why that line is good. But I like what Doctorow said. Doctorow said, yeah, but how do you know what you know? You know? And so yeah, I mean, you don't want to get locked too much into injecting your life experience. You know, so I've worked all kinds of blue-collar jobs, and, you know, I've become a real carpenter. I can say I'm a carpenter without feeling like a liar. But I would do myself a disservice, I think, to say, well, I'm going to inject what I know about carpentry. Instead, just start writing. And maybe a carpenter will show up. But forget jobs for a second. The psyche shows up. I've learned more about... There is more of me in some female characters I've written than male. And, you know, I learned something about... There is a piece of me in House of Sand and Fog. There's some of me in that colonel. There's some of me in that addictive, weak Kathy. There's some of me in that reactionary, short-tempered Lester. You know? And there's a lot of me in this new book. So if I thought about it, maybe they wouldn't show up.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of research do you do then? And I'm imagining a lot. With The Garden of Last Days, you write from the point of view of a stripper. You're in an extremist, a terrorist psyche. You're in a baby psyche. You were in the point of view of a wife beater or accused wife beater.
Yeah.
What are you taking all of them from? Are you doing a ton of research into those kind of people? Are you reading a lot?
No.
Are
you... Thank you for asking that question. No, I would never read psychology about somebody. You know, and I want to put down psychology as a discipline. Lord knows it's very helpful to us. But I'll tell you what, I think it's important just to get the specifics. I do a lot of research on jobs. I wasn't a strip club goer. I went to one when I was 20, drunk, and hadn't been back. So I went down to Florida to these clubs, where these men were actually seen, and I just soaked up the atmosphere for 3 days. I interviewed. Instead of getting a lap dance, I would ask a woman dancing if I could just pay her $20 a song to ask her questions, and she said yes. I didn't even tell her I was a writer. I just want to know about this life. And I just kind of absorbed it. With the Saudi character, you know, he's one of 7 in the book, but he's a, you know, important character. I stopped writing the novel for 4 months and read probably 30 books and interviewed 6 people, beginning with an overview of Islam and then the history of Saudi Arabia and then the Quran cover to cover, on and on and on, until I felt I had enough information and learned knowledge to then try to convert it in that weird alchemy into true experience. I feel like I got off the point of your question.
Oh, just research and how much do you know, or do you feel that you need to know?
Yeah, well, thank you. So I think it's very important, for example, for instance, in this book, where's the money go? And, you know, I did not know that strippers don't get paid by the house they work for. They actually have to pay the house.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. So that's a huge piece of learning. So when you get details like that, I think it's then important not to ask somebody anything psychological. So if I'm writing from the point of view of a prostitute, I want to ask her, you know, do you have sex in the car? Is it in the alley? Are you one of these hotel people? How much money do you get? Where do you put it? Do you have a separate account? But I would never ask, how do you feel after or before or during? Because that, as you know, is the joy of writing, is we're writing to discover that.
Mm.
You know, I had insomnia a few years ago. A few years ago, I have it all the time. A few years ago, I was up, and I'm watching Charlie Rose interview Mike Nichols, like 3 in the morning, you know, the film director.
Mm-hmm.
And Rose asks him, what's the question that the storyteller asks before creating story. And Nichols said, well, it's not the question the newspaper reporter asks. He said, what the newspaper reporter asks is, what happened? But Barbara, you know what he said the storyteller asks? Not what happened, but what's it like? What's it really like to be in this thing that's happened? So I think for research, you want to research all the parameters, all the what's, but as Hemingway said, not the whys. So you get the whys through the writing.
Yes. I'm with Andre Debuse, author of The Garden of Last Days. We have a few more minutes. Lots more to talk about. One thing I've been curious about is, and it has to do with the difference between, say, literary fiction and suspense fiction. A suspense novelist I know, Elizabeth George, said that in the early days when she got stuck on a book, her then husband would say, just kill somebody off. But it's not so easy to do when you're a literary novelist. So do you ever get stuck? And when you do, what do you do?
That's a great question. Yeah, I get stuck all the time. And you know what? It's like getting stuck in a relationship. I've been married almost 20 years, so I'll speak about marriage. To me, it's when my wife and I are drifting, we're not spending enough time together. We're one of these couples who the more time we spend together, the better we get along. And I realize we feel far away from each other when we're not asking each other enough questions about each other. Because, you know, people take each other for granted. And you get busy, and you get tired, and then you get mad at each other, and, you know, we all know the drill. So what's this have to do with writing? I think we get stuck when we, A, write a lie and then won't admit it to ourselves, where here we are trying to imagine the story, and then we make up something. And it's written so well, we're afraid to admit, she never would have done that. Oh, man, what did I write? But when we finally acknowledge, wait a minute, she never would have done that, and then have the courage to cut it, which then sometimes means cutting 7 months of work after that and a support wall, which brings down two floors of writing, that's one reason we get stuck, is we know we've got to do some major revision, which means re-seeing, and we haven't got the courage to do it for, obvious reasons. I think another one is not that we've written a lie into the story and we're feeling queasy about actually admitting it and doing the action to fix it. I think it's the other thing, which is we've just stopped asking enough questions. You know, again, back to that O'Connor essay, The Nature and Name of Fiction, she's got another great line. She said, I love this. And this is very encouraging, too. She said, there is a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without, and that is the quality of having to stare. So many writers, again, this is why it's another good reason not to give a damn about your agent calling or a publisher noticing or anyone noticing, but just to work with you and the spirits within and not think about the outside world, because sometimes the work requires you just to sit there and stare at the page or the screen or whatever it is you work with and wait. She also said writing is waiting. That doesn't mean waiting to feel inspired. It means waiting for the next moment. And sometimes that sticking point is weeks or months, and that's my two cents on that.
Sure. No, that's great. That's great. It does take a ton of patience, and like you said, asking the questions, it's a great way of looking at it. You mentioned agents, and I know your agent, and you have a wonderful agent, and how important are agents to a writer's life, to a writer, to publishing, to being concerned with that, to doing your best work? I mean, do you feel that your agent helps keep you on track? Should an agent help keep you on track career-wise? I don't know. I mean, what do you have to say about agents?
I mean, my agent's Philip Spitzer, and not only is he my agent, but he's a dear, close family friend and friend of mine, and I love him and his family. Number one, I think the big thing an agent gives a writer who is especially, well, depends on where you are in your writing career. When you're just starting out, really people need an agent, because what agents do is they know people in publishing. It's really not the contracts they have to get you through. It's, hey, you know, Joe over at HarperCollins likes this, I'll send it to him. Oh, no, Sally over at Random House just turned one down like this, I won't send it to her. That's what you're paying an agent for, to know people and help, you know, shepherd your work into the publishing world, and then to protect it and you in any way he or she can. Now, I have to say, though, one of the things I love about Philip, my agent, is he's got a light touch and he doesn't bother me. So, you know, I had a really successful experience with House of Sand and Fog, and then, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but that was 9 years ago. So most agents freak out. Hey, where's the follow-up? Where's the follow-up? You're hot, baby. Come on, crank it out, crank it out. And he doesn't do that, and I appreciated him not doing that. Because here's the danger, back to what we've been saying all along, Barbara, is I think there's a profound difference between the writing and the career.
Mm-hmm.
And while, look, I'm not poo-pooing career. Believe me, I'm very happy to have one. It's helped me take care of my wife and kids in a way I never would have been able to as a carpenter or all the other crap I was doing. Not crap. The other jobs I was doing. Some of it was crap, believe me. And I'm grateful for it. But I got to tell you, I never think about it. Except now. Now I'm on a book tour.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it all the time, and I honestly don't like it. I don't like thinking about where my book is on the bestseller list. Is it on the bestseller list? Oh, he got a bigger advance. Oh, this review is not so good. Oh, this review is too good. Oh, you know. By the way, I don't read reviews for that reason. I just don't read them. Even if they're really good, I just don't read them. Back to what we were saying about self-consciousness. It just makes you self-conscious. If it's lousy, as a writer, you believe only the bad one anyway. And by the way, you know, a nasty dig at you or your work will show up 5 years later at the desk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not helpful. It's not going to help you change anyway, and it's just going to make it harder to create honestly in the future. So to finish about the agent, I would say if the agent has a heavy hand, tell him or her to back off because the writing is more important than the career, and once the writing's done, it's up to the agent to make sure you've got a career, but it's not your... You know what? The career is out of the writer's hands, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
The career is really none of our business, in a strange way.
Hmm.
I mean, on one level, that's disingenuous for me to say that, because here I am talking to you on a radio show as I promote my new book, but I don't know. I'm really talking, you know, one writer to another. That's what we're talking about, the work. We're not talking about selling books.
Yes. Well, in terms of the writing, how early on in a project do you seek feedback? Do you get through the draft before you have anybody at all look at it? Do you write a few chapters and you ask your wife, look?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked. No, I get a draft out of me, and, you know, I'm slow. You know, House of Sand and Fog. When I started House of Sand and Fog, we were pregnant with our first child, and when I finished House of Sand and Fog, we had three kids. When I started The Garden of Last Days, I was framing my first wall of this house, and now we've been living here for 3 years, and I've just finished the book. I need to give birth to the baby. I really need to get it out. Let's move away from the baby analogy. Let's look at clay on the table. I need to get clay on the table. Here's a better analogy, and I forget who said this, some woman writer whose work I respect, but I forget her name, but she said, look, if a story or novel is a steel bridge over a river, then in that first draft, you have to create the iron.
Hmm.
I mean, it's really important for young writers to think about that, because the real work, as you know, is the rewriting. So you've got to first just create the iron. You've got to create the materials that you make the thing with. And so it's completely unhelpful for me to show it to anyone, because it's just premature. If I show it to my agent, he's going to want to steer it to what will make it more commercial. If I show it to my wife, she might want to steer it to something that makes me look more attractive to her. I don't know. But whatever, it's not going to help the it, is what I'm saying. So, no,
yeah.
I wait till there's a beginning, middle, and end. And even then, I may not show it until I've rewritten it a few times. And then have at it. I'll show it to two or three people whose opinion I trust, who I know will tell me the truth. And whatever they tell me that feels right, I'll go back with it.
You mentioned the real work is in the rewriting. Can you briefly sort of say what that's like for you? I mean, you know, how do you go about it?
Yeah. Well, you know what? The word to revise, as you know, means to see again.
Hmm.
And you know when you go on a trip and you come back to your house and the doorknob is loose in the front and you say, has that front step always been crooked? And you walk in and what's that smell? Does my house always smell like this? You realize, yeah, that's the smell of your house. And is that wall really that dirty? And haven't I had that photograph for like 20 years? And why is it still above that dead plant? You know what I'm saying? You've you've walked away, and now you've got new eyes. And so the first thing I would say is walk away from it. Walk away. I know one writer, Susan Dodd, close friend, beautiful writer, who actually has the courage to put whatever book she finishes in a drawer for 1 year.
Hmm.
1 year, and then she'll go back and read it. So she's really got new eyes. With Garden of Last Days, I put it down for 3 months and worked on something else, then went back to it. So that helps you. First of all, it cools off. You're not as emotionally attached. And then, to answer your question, it's a matter, for me, of primarily this. Certainly I'll work on the sentences and try to make them really nice, but not right away. The first thing I'm doing is reading it through with my sort of truth radar on full power, asking myself, do I believe this moment? Do I believe this line? Do I think she really did this and then did that? And if I ever get to a doubt, I rewrite the scene till it's truer. And then, after that's all done, try to make the sentences as, you know, original and musical as I can.
Hmm. Good answer. Another good answer. And we're at the end of our time. Do you have any last words for our listeners who are writers?
Yeah. Well, first, you know, be thankful that you found a creative art form, because so many people live their lives without ever finding that. And it's a, look, even a rainy Tuesday afternoon where you're worried about bills and your writing session went badly is a better day than when you didn't write at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is be grateful you've got this expression at your fingertips. And then don't expect the world to notice too much. Because by doing that, we go back to this self-consciousness we've been talking about. And then the very thing that pulled you to the desk, which is this rapturous desire to create something true, will be harder to do. So let go of the world noticing. Let go of your mother approving. Let go of thoughts of publication and glory and cocktail fame, cocktail party fame. Let go of all that. Realize that you're only on this earth for a short time. May we all live, again, 140 years. And lastly, don't outline it. Go one true scene, one true sentence to the next, and see where it goes, because what I've learned over the years, it goes somewhere.
Mm. You have been just a delight, and thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Barbara. It's really been enjoyable.
Thank you. That was André Debus III, author of The Garden of Last Days, published by Norton, speaking to us from New England, and he's on book tour, so if you're listening from New England, you are sure to find him. Somewhere throughout. I think he's in Vermont in the next couple of days at North Shore Bookstore in Manchester and all over. So check out your independent bookstores and your not-so-independent bookstores and find him. We're going to go now. If you want to know more about the show, go to my website, which is penonfire.com, and you can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Catherine Mansfield, who said, "Better to write twaddle, anything, than nothing at all." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next time.